Charles Spurgeon said, "I think the moments we are nearer heaven are the moments we spend at the Lord's table." I got to agree with Chuck Spurgeon. That's very insightful because I so often feel the same way. I feel so close to the Lord. I feel close to one another in the fellowship when we're at the Lord's table. Nothing draws us together as realizing that standing before the foot of the cross, we're all at the same level. None is higher, none is lower, none is better, none is worse. All of us can be participants of the same grace. The New Testament makes it clear that when we approach the Lord's Supper, the table of the Lord for communion, that we're to make a self-examination. We're to think about our lives. We're not to do it in a superficial manner, but as it says in 1 Corinthians 11, "Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord." It's very important to understand that. He says an unworthy manner. He doesn't say if you are an unworthy person, because we would all be disqualified, frankly. None of us are worthy of the least of God's mercies. In fact, that's the whole idea behind mercy and grace, is we don't deserve them. But he's speaking of the manner in which we take it. It's to be done in a holy manner. It's to be done in a way that fits the occasion of the Lord's Supper. Reflection, examination. In fact, an honest reflection will cultivate meaningful participation. I think we can get fully engaged when we examine our hearts and we realize we're growing, God has been faithful, but there are those areas God is dealing with. I'll be honest with them and about them before the Lord and, if need be, before each other, if I need to confess sin to someone. One writer said, "A Christian's attitude and motives should be pure at all times. But when believers come to the table of the Lord, sharing the bread of his body and the cup of his blood, it is absolutely necessary that they leave behind all sin, all bitterness, all racial and sexual prejudice, all class pride, and all feelings of superiority. Of all places and occasions, those attitudes are most out of place. It is at the Lord's Supper. They grievously profane the holy, beautiful, and unifying ordinance of God." So before we take communion tonight, we're going to give all of us the opportunity to pause and do that. We have been on Wednesday nights doing a study in the book of Judges. And as you know, we were having communion on Sunday nights. And if you were here for a long time, you know that we used to do it on Thursday nights when we had a Thursday night study. And now we're back to the midweek just because of we just think with the children's ministry and with all the activities going on that this is a good time to do it. But because we're going through Judges and yet this is communion, tonight I want to interface both of those elements. Studying for the Lord's Supper, but from something we left off last time in the book of Judges. Now, when Jesus instituted communion, the Lord's table, he did it the evening before his crucifixion in an upper room at the Jewish Passover meal. It was not coincidental. It was not accidental that Jesus instituted this service at the Passover. Because just as God instituted Passover thousands of years before in Jewish history after they had been delivered or when they were being delivered from Egypt after being there 400 years, it was signifying the release from captivity and the entering into a covenant. You know the story. On that Passover, they were to take the blood of a lamb. They were to smear the blood on the lintels and the doorpost of the house. The angel of death would pass over their house. They would be spared. They would be given life while the rest of Egypt is given death. It was the blood of the lamb shed that brought them life. And so Jesus, bringing together the significance of the old and yet establishing the new, before he was crucified, brought the disciples together in that upper room, and he gave the elements, and he said, this is the blood of the new covenant, and this body is the, or this is the bread of my body that is broken for you. And he took that ancient significance and gave it brand new, profound significance. We have been going through Judges, as I mentioned, and Judges is a story of failure. Here's the sad thing, and I think it's apropos to consider a communion. God established a covenant with Israel. They had been in bondage for 400 years. They were glad to get out of bondage. Even if it meant the wilderness, they were happy to get out. This only lasted a few weeks. Then they were out in the desert for a while, and they started complaining about that, and they complained all the way to the promised land. But they were under a new covenant. They had been released from bondage. In the book of Judges, they go through this crazy cycle. Having been delivered from bondage, brought into the new land, they're back to their old ways, complaining, but it gets worse. Not only do they complain, they start thinking, well, maybe the grass is greener on the other side spiritually. So they start flirting with other gods and goddesses, and they go through this sin cycle that is mentioned 7 times in the book of Judges. They go back into bondage. First of all, there was rebellion. They got tired of God. They went through the rituals, they went through the motion, but frankly, they got tired of following God. And because they got tired of following God, in their rebellion, they started entertaining other worship systems. They became very open to other methods of approaching God. And what they were doing, it's like double dating somebody. Or being married to somebody and then going out on them. They were committing a spiritual fornication or spiritual adultery. That's what the Bible calls it. Well, that's the first phase, rebellion. Second phase was retribution. God had something to say about it. He didn't like it. And in showing his disapproval, he allowed the children of Israel that didn't want anything to do with him to have everything to do with being captive once again. And so they started worshiping the different gods and goddesses of the people groups in Canaan. God said, fine, if you like them that much. He sold them as slaves into that people group. Retribution. Then Israel started thinking, yeah, I don't know about worshiping these gods and goddesses. It hasn't really been good for us. Now we're slaves again. We're in captivity once again. What do we do? So, third phase of the sin cycle. Repentance. They cried out to God, oh God, we're sorry, help us. And God sent them a deliverer, a judge. Finally, they had rest. Finally, they had rest. Sometimes for a period of a few years, sometimes of a period for many years. Now, what happened to the nation of Israel can happen to an individual. Free from bondage. But then starting to go back to those old patterns, those old habits, the old ways, we start rationalizing and thinking, they weren't that bad. I could probably still go to heaven and yet get involved in that activity. And we can follow some of the same patterns. That's why we need to examine ourselves. Where are we truly with the Lord in this walk and this commitment with Jesus Christ? Maybe your walk is sort of like that tonight. Released from captivity, but starting to go back now to the old way. We have been dealing, when we left off last time, we finished chapter 7 of Judges, with a guy named Gideon. A great guy. But something happened to Gideon that I just mentioned. Here's a guy that not only was delivered from captivity, he was one of the deliverers who brought the children of Israel during one of these sin sessions, these cycles, out of their captivity. Yet, at the end of his life, he follows personally the same cycle, the sin cycle that the nation did publicly. Same thing happened to him personally. Let me just recap about this guy so you can see as we read it, you'll just blow your mind. Gideon was by nature sort of a fearful guy. He was threshing wheat rather than on the threshing floor atop one of the windswept, rocky areas of Israel, the mountains. He was down in the valley at the wine press. Very simply, because if he was on the top of the mountain, he could be seen. The Midianites would kill him, and he was scared that would happen. So he threshes the wheat down by the wine press. Problem is, there's no wind at the wine press. So you throw the stuff up in the air, and the wind doesn't catch it. It just sort of falls all over down your collar, on your clothing. It's very frustrating. But he was down there doing it because he lacked the courage to go on top. He didn't want to die. So the angel of the Lord appears to him and says, "Gideon, you're a mighty man of valor." I think tongue in cheek. I think he probably just said, "Hey, Gideon, you're so courageous." And I bet even Gideon went, who are you talking to? Then God said that he would use him to deliver the children of Israel in captivity to the Midianites out of their hands. The odds were pretty staggering. You see, there was 135,000 Midianites. And Gideon managed to assemble 32,000 Israelites against 135,000 Midianites. He was outgunned, he was outnumbered, he was outmanned. But he went out by faith until God said to Gideon, "You have too many troops." "Pardon me, Lord?" "That's right. You have too many troops. You've got 32,000 men. You have too many." "Oh, Lord, listen, I don't want to be a math teacher to you or anything, but they have 135,000. We're severely outnumbered. I'm going by faith on this, but don't you think they have too many?" "No, you have too many for me to deliver them into your hands. See, I don't need 32,000. They'll get in my way because I'm going to do the work, not you. So go to your troops and tell them, anybody who's afraid, anybody who's faint-hearted, who doesn't want to fight, you're scared, battles make you queasy, go home." So Gideon goes out there and he gives the announcement, thinking, "Oh, maybe two or three. Okay, listen, anybody scared and want to go home?" 22,000 went home. Now he's got 10,000 men left. And he's thinking, 135,000? 10,000. This is ridiculous. God comes to him again and says, "Gideon, I hate to break the news to you. You still have too many. Too many men for me to do the work. Go down to the water, down to the riverbanks, and watch how the men drink. If they get all the way down on all fours and put their head into the water and drink that way, set them aside. But the people who draw the water up in their hands and drink this way, you set them aside. 300 did the latter." And God said, "Let everybody else go home. By the 300 men, I will deliver Israel from the Midianites." So we went out, and we covered that battle last time. But something happens to Gideon that is not good. And in chapter 8, you don't need to turn to it necessarily because the light isn't all that good, and so we don't expect you to strain your eyes. But I'm just going to read a few verses. The bulk of the chapter is they go after the enemy and they basically mop up the operation. But down in verse 22 of chapter 8, the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." Now, Gideon knew more than anybody else, he didn't do anything. He didn't do anything. 300 men, 135,000 Midianites. He and the armor bearer went up to the camp, heard a conversation going on that God was going to deliver the enemy into their hands, and they knew it was God. But the people are looking now to him. "Gideon, you did this." People have a hard time. In fact, I think we all do. Have a difficult time trusting somebody you cannot see. This invisible God, we don't see him. Peter said, "In whom having not seen, yet you trust, you believe, and you love." But not seeing God is difficult. We see the effect of God. We see his hand moving in our lives, those of us who trust him on a daily basis, I think. But people did want some visible leadership. After all, Moses was visible. Joshua was visible. There's no real leader bringing the nation together, no king. And so they say, we want you to be our king. Not the first time, not the last time. The very next chapter, they're going to make the son of this man the king at Shechem. Later on, they're going to say to Saul, we want you to be our king. They want visible leadership. But Gideon said to them, here's his response. Good at first. I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. It's a good sermon that he gave, and I agree with him. The Lord will rule over you. Why would you settle for a monarchy when you can have a theocracy? Why will you let the people rule with a king when God will rule? Why would you settle for man's authority when you can have God's authority? I love what David said. You're familiar, Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. The Lord wants to be your shepherd. Why would you settle for a human authority and a human shepherd? Oh, I've got to find my shepherd to ask if this is okay. I've got to, you know, my shepherd will tell me what to do. And there was a movement, it's still sort of in vogue in some places, called the shepherding movement, where you cannot make any decision, you cannot buy anything unless your shepherd says it's okay. And so people will say, would you be my personal shepherd? And you tithe to that shepherd personally and et cetera, et cetera. Hey, why would you settle for that when the Lord will be your shepherd? And so Gideon has it right. I'm not going to rule over you. Let God rule over you. Let God maintain that place of authority. However, I believe when they asked Gideon to rule, they planted a seed within him. He heard what they were saying behind the request. They were saying, Gideon, you are amazing. You are something special. In fact, you're so awesome. We saw you. That we want you to be in charge from now on. Now, he didn't become their king, but he acted like their king. He does get lifted up with pride at this, the latter part of his life. Gideon said to them, listen carefully. I would like to make a request of you that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder. For they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And so they answered, we will gladly give them. And they spread out a garment, and each man threw into the earrings from his plunder. Now the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, beside the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and beside the chains that were around their camel's neck. He didn't become their king, but he acted like it. He sure lived like it. It's interesting. Oh no, I won't be your king. God will be your king. However, I would like to take an offering. You wouldn't mind that now. They're at a vulnerable point. No, not at all. You delivered us from our enemy. Anything you want. Well, good. And he asked for about 40 pounds of gold. The Ishmaelites, the Midianites, wore these golden crescents in their ears or their noses. And they took these and put them all together. And he had it made. He was quite wealthy. As we read on, we find out the guy has many wives. So he has to be quite wealthy to support, well, it's, you know how it is to support one. And children. You know, a family isn't an easy thing these days, but many wives that gave him 70 sons, 70 kids. Plus he had a concubine that gave him one son. By the way, the name of that one son was Abimelech, which means my father is king. Interesting. Oh no, I won't be your king, but I like the money. And then he names his son, my father is king. So he acts like a king with the people. This is the beginning of his downfall. He's experiencing a personal falling away, if you will. He has weathered the storm of adversity, but he's having problem with a storm called prosperity. At first he began saying, oh, who am I? I can't deliver the children of Israel. I'm nothing. But he's ending up saying, look who I am. I am something. Pride destroys absolutely everything God builds. Pride destroys marriages. Pride destroys churches and ministries. It ruins things. Then Gideon made it into an ephod, and he set it in his city, Ophrah. And all of Israel, listen to these words, played the harlot with it there. They played the harlot with it there. In other words, it's an idol. They're worshiping something other than God. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. Now here's the wild thing. Is when Gideon started, his father was an idol worshiper. He had a Baal and a statue of Asherah in his backyard. And God said to Gideon, go rip it down. Go build a new altar. Take the wood they used for the statue and burn it as firewood. Sacrifice an animal to the Lord your God. Now he's reverting back to the very same sin of his father in his hometown, the sin of the children of Israel. He's entering into the sin cycle himself. It became a snare to Gideon. And his household and the people of Israel are worshiping an image rather than God. You know, I bet it started out to be fairly innocent. He might have said, well, you know, these people don't have a visible leader. So I want to set up this image, this statue, this ephod with all the gold on it, to remind them of God. It'll just sort of get the juices flowing of their worship. They'll see it and they go, oh, yes. But they began worshiping that thing rather than what perhaps it was supposed to represent. It became a snare and an idol. Here's the end of the chapter. Thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so they lifted their heads no more. The country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, who is Gideon, went and dwelt in his own house. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son whose name was called Abimelech. My dad is the king. Now Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age. He was buried in the tomb of Joash's father in Ophrah, not Oprah, Ophrah of the Abiezrites. So it was, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the house of Gideon in accordance with the good that he had done for Israel. His pride led to compromise. His compromise led to greed. His greed led to irrational behavior because he set up an ephod and people worshiped it when he himself knew God miraculously used me to deliver the children of Israel. But here's a guy who started out so well and ended up so poorly. And perhaps it was because he was going along making justifications, making decisions without really consulting God, really without any accountability. And eventually, just one compromise led to another, perhaps because there was no self-examination. And so back to the thought we began with. We approach the Lord's table. Time for self-examination. 1 Corinthians 11, Paul said, let a man examine himself, and so let him eat the bread and drink of the cup. In the business world, there's a proverb that a man who makes no inventories will become bankrupt very soon. Let's take spiritual inventory, spiritual stock. Have we compromised? Is there an activity that we have a suspicion doesn't glorify God, or we flat out know it doesn't? Somebody has even called us to account because of it. We just said, no big deal. You know, God's grace will cover it. So what? But one compromise can lead to another. Understand that with Gideon, it didn't have to happen. It shouldn't have happened. He saw what happened to the nation of Israel. He saw the captivity they were in. He was part of it. And seeing the miraculous hand of God in appearing to him, on another occasion, fire came up out of a rock and consumed the meat that he had prepared for his visitor. There was the miraculous sign of the fleece on the threshing floor that had dew on it. It was wet while the rest of it was dry, and then vice versa. There was the providential miracle of God when Gideon went into the camp of the Midianites and overheard a conversation how the enemies were frightened of Gideon with his small band of men. All of that made him walk away each time going, wow, God is with us. And then the victory. And after the victory, those 300 men wiping out thousands of the enemy. You think that he would have ended his life solely, completely sold out to God. But he made choices, bad choices. When I first moved to this fair city from the West Coast, one of the first people I met at an apartment one night was a man who had been in the ministry for years and was now out of the ministry because of moral failure. He knew he was disqualified by sins he had committed. And he took me aside and he warned me, "Don't let happen to you what happened to me. Gone are the days of serving the Lord like I used to. Gone is the joy that I once knew. Don't let that happen to you. Don't walk where I've walked." And so we examine ourselves. F.B. Meyer said, "This is the bitterest of all, to know that the suffering need not have been, that it has resulted from indiscretion and inconsistency, that it is the harvest of one's own sowing, that the vulture which feeds on the vitals is a nestling of one's own rearing. Oh, me," said Meyer, "that is pain." In just a moment, we're going to be really quiet before the Lord and ask the Spirit of God to personally reveal things to our hearts. I know you're going to be tempted, "Oh Lord, reveal this to my husband's heart. Reveal this to my wife's heart. Reveal this to, you know, that creep that sits a couple rows up. That is his heart. He needs it." But we're going to examine ourselves and let God take care of the rest. And ask, is there any pride that has crept into your relationship? Are you taking anything for granted with the Lord? Maybe the time of devotion, the time of Bible study, reading, prayer, etc. And ask the Spirit of God just to reveal it to you personally. Because I look at guys like Gideon, who shouldn't have ended up this way, but they did. And I'm reminded of the prayer of Dr. H.A. Ironside a few years back, who would often pray, "Oh Lord, don't let me die a foolish old man." Good prayer. Don't let me end up a fool. And so we take spiritual inventory as we approach the Lord's Supper. And we say, what do I need in my life? What do I lack? Or what do I have that God is trying to prune out? Or maybe tonight you would realize there is no relationship with God. There is pure ritual, but no relationship. You attend church, you even bought a Bible, and you'll drag your body to church once a week. But you have to admit there's no personal covenant with the Lord God. You haven't asked him to save your soul. You haven't repented of your sins and turned your life to him. You're not following him. That ought to change tonight as well. Why don't we just take a few moments, examine your heart, ask God to deal with you. No talking, no conferring, just ask the Spirit of God to move. As God begins to speak to your heart, and you ask him to change you, and you ask him to forgive you, you ask him to deliver you from that cycle of sin that perhaps you're caught in, then receive his forgiveness. Understand that if we confess our sins, God is faithful and just to forgive us all of our sin and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Embrace that forgiveness. We who are unworthy have and are taking the cup of the Lord in a worthy manner. How do we do that? How do we take the elements of the Lord's Supper worthily? I think it's first by recognizing that our salvation is solely based upon the gift he gave, the grace he gave. We cannot earn it on our own. We don't deserve it. To take this worthily, then, is to admit our own lack of worth That honors God. It dishonors God if we were to say, well, thanks for the start, but I think I can manage on my own. We realize we're helpless, and it's in that helpless state that we approach the Lord's table and we recognize, were it not by God's good grace and mercy, salvation would be impossible. That is taking it in a worthy manner. It is to do it in a manner of respect. That though these are just elements, they represent so much more. And even as we place the bread in our mouth and we drink the juice, we are partaking of Christ. Not necessarily because of the elements, but it is a tangible sermon, a demonstration. That we have partaken of Christ. We have brought him into our lives. We have become one. We have fellowship. That recognition pleases God, and we do it worthily. There's a final thing that we should, if we haven't yet, be determined to do so when we're done, that would make this a worthy manner of taking the Lord's Supper. And that is, if there is any grudge, any bitterness, any unforgiveness that needs to be dealt with, to reconcile, to deal with it. It's interesting that while Jesus was making the Passover significant as the communion service, even there in the upper room, the disciples were arguing as to who would be the greatest in the kingdom. At the Lord's table, they're having an argument. So the Bible says when supper was ended and Jesus loved them to the end, he got up after the supper, put a towel around his waist, got a basin of water, and started going from disciple to disciple, undoing their sandals and washing their crusty feet. And then afterwards, Jesus said, do you know what I've done? I've given you an example that as I have done to you, you should do to others. As I have loved you, so love one another. And so the Son of God served people, loved them. The ones that were arguing. Let's be determined when the supper is over to get things right if they are not right with another believer. To not live in bitterness. It's not worth it. It's just not worth it. Clear your heart if you need to.